For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we're in Genesis, starting in 5 and kind of grinding our way through tonight because the narrative moves super quickly. And last time we were together, we talked about Cain murdering Abel. And the point what we're going to be making here in a second is that that really fits into this broader pattern that's observable in the book of Genesis, of things going wrong and then God stepping in and really moving the story forward in terms of his getting behind what's best for humankind. Let's take a look at this. It says in chapter 4, verse 25, that Adam had relations with his wife again. And she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, for he said, God has appointed me another son in the place of Abel, for Cain killed him. So in that sense, Seth comes along to continue a line that Cain has killed. And to Seth, it says, was born a son named Enosh. And at that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. And this is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, he created him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them and named them man, or literally Adam. That's where we get the word Adam from. Now let's take a step back about see what's going on here. It's really all about history. And again, we've been at pains to differentiate between the mythological stories of human origins that are a part of the world's religious literature and what we're presented by in the book of Genesis, which is not mythology, it is narrative history. And here's an evidence of it right here in verse 1 of chapter 5. This is the book of the generations of Adam, the Talidoth, as it's called in the Hebrew. It's the idea of an accounting. History is really what that is. And so that's what we're being presented with here, biblical history. And biblical history moves along not just the lines of cause and effect of people doing what they do to people and working in a natural environment, but really it's history that's guided along by the person of God and his purposes for the world. And so we are presented here with a new family line. Since Abel is now out of the picture, God, in a certain sense, replaces this family line with Seth. And with that, a renewal of the creation blessing. So anyone who's read Genesis 1 and 2 and the story of the human creation will remember the lines that come out of Genesis 1, that God created man in his own likeness. He created him male and female, and he blessed them, said, be fruitful and multiply. About 80% of the language of the creation of man in Genesis 1 is brought back here in Genesis chapter 5. It's to carry on this idea that while human beings are going to rebel against God's design, God's purposes for their life, God grants us freedom, and so things like murder happen. But that doesn't mean that God is silent. God is active. God's involved. And in the birth of Seth, the work of God in history continues on. And here, let's just illustrate a little bit from the book of Genesis. What do I mean by the work of God continues to progress even in the face of human disobedience to God? There's a whole pattern here. These guys blew it. They all blew it bad. Okay? Adam, God said, you can eat whatever you want in this garden, but do not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for on the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. And so what did Adam do? Just a page later, he's like chowing down. And he's violating God's word, God's will, God's purpose, God's design. Then along comes Adam's son, Cain. And Cain is the first murderer, the first human action that we have any description of right after the creation is murder. Things are not going well for humanity. Yeah, and they're going to get worse. Because we move from Cain, a murderer, to his descendant Lamech, who is just a callous murderer, then now to the flood in chapters 6 through 8, that God is acting in judgment against a humanity that is just completely off the rails, morally and spiritually. And then in chapter 11, after the flood, Humanity reconvenes and decides that they're going to continue their ways of defiance against God. They're going to build a tower into heaven, stairway to heaven, as it were. And God's like, no, it's not going to go down like that. But for all of these failures, we are also met then with God intervening and working his purposes. And so even after the curse of the land and of Adam and Eve and the death that has been brought upon the human race by the rebellion against God in the garden, nonetheless, there is the promise of this seed that comes from woman in Genesis 3, verse 15, which is the promise of a future champion, one who will defeat Satan and the powers of death that Satan brought. So there's a word of hope even in the middle of this terrible denunciation. Then that promise of seed, that word of redemption, moves forward with Seth. So we had match Cain's failure with God's provision of Seth. And Seth, we are told, is a fresh start. It's like the creation story told all over again, that God continues to bless even though humanity's in this broken and fallen place. And then the promise moves forward with Noah, that even though humanity is under the just punishment of God for their outrageous rebellion against him, and this is not a good day for human history, yet at the same time, God is at work, and he raises up Noah. And he says of Noah in chapter 5, verse 29, he will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground that the Lord has cursed. In other words, there's a conscious connection between this seed promise, reversing the course of the curse through Seth and to Noah. That Noah is, in the mind of his father Lamech, the one that God is pointing to as the one who will deliver. And he does deliver in an important way, but not in the final sense. Noah, super important. Even after the end of the flood and Noah's work is complete, we're told in chapter 9, verse 1, that again that creation blessing is poured out on humanity. And he tells them in Genesis 9, just as he did in Genesis 1, go be fruitful and multiply. It's God's desire to bless people. And he's going to do that through Noah and despite human failure. And then, of course, there's the Tower of Babel story in chapter 11, where humanity conspires to essentially invade the kingdom of God, to heaven. And while that is an abysmal failure and the people are dispersed, their language is confounded, at the same time, then God raises up another member of this progression that begins with the seed promise to Seth, then to Noah, then finally to Abraham. And the promise given, which we'll be exploring in a couple of weeks in great detail, that just as the world is scattered and the curse with them, so the promise of universal blessing comes with Abraham, that in you, that is in your seed, in your descendant, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. So I want you to understand this theme, because this is so fundamental to our understanding, to our reading of the book of Genesis. And every place we are going to be, we're going to see that contrast between human failure and the goodness of God as he continues to move toward creation and toward the real needs that human beings have. And we're going to see that in spades here tonight. Let's get back to our text then. We're told in chapter 5, verse 3, after 130 years, Adam became the father of a son of his own likeness according to the image, and he named him Seth, and Adam lived for another 800 years, and after that had other sons and daughters. That seems complicated. So all the days of Adam were 930 years, then he died, and Seth lived 105 years and became the father of Enosh. So all the years of Seth were 912 years, and he died, and then the story just continues to go forward from there. There are 10 generations from Adam to Noah. There are 10 generations from Noah's sons Shem to Abraham. And between these two genealogies is the flood. That seems to be the dividing line between what the early chapters of Genesis and everything else that is going to come after. So, but it raises, I think, some important questions. And namely, you've got this string of patriarchs that are living for a very long period of time, having children deep in their old age, and it just seems so far removed from anything that we experience. And there are a couple observations of this text that we need to make. And the first is that it does not follow that these genealogies are strict chronologies, that one line follows exactly where the line before it leaves off. That's really not how chronology works in the Bible, and we know that for a fact. The word son, so one man begets another, has a son, does not mean that at necessarily doesn't mean at 800 years old, you know, this man has a son, because the word son, Ben, relates not just to a physical son, but also a kinship line. Could be a grandson, or even a farther, more remote person even than that. And there are examples of this use of the word Ben or son relating to someone other than the direct son of a person in Genesis 31. In Matthew's story of the genealogy of Jesus, in Matthew chapter 1, verse 8, Matthew skips a whole number of kings from 2 Kings 8 kings list because they just don't fit his purposes. And the idea is to show lines of descent and not a strict chronology from one generation to the next. And I think that that's an important part of just our understanding of this genealogical record and historic perspective. But moving on, there is also this question about these super old people. It's like, wow. I mean, that really even stretches The Hobbit a few notches. You know, 960 years, stuff like this. And I want to think about this here with you this evening, and also the question of the flood, because it just seems like from where I sit and from where most of us sit, these long ages from Adam to Noah, and they occur nowhere else in the Bible, by the way. But in the pre-flood genealogies, you have these really long lifespan. It just seems like kind of unreal. And so I want to ask this question. How should we think about things like this? Clearly, this is not some central teaching in the Bible, like the resurrection of Jesus Christ or something like that. But that doesn't mean that we can just diminish it, walk away, or just kind of ignore it. How do we deal with something that seems so far from our experience as people living to this incredible old age? And there are four principles, I think, of how we look at difficult passages like this in the Bible. One is to be aware of our own biases. And I think that that's very important. The miraculous to modern Western people just seems like really hard to believe at all. And we are biased in the direction that says that only cause and effect in a closed universe of material causes explains everything that happens. And so the thought of the miraculous or something that's widely beyond even within the natural sphere, our own experience, just seems implausible. But is it really implausible, especially if there's a God? The range of possible meanings in the text itself. We may ask the question, well, what does it mean, these years, these really long years? Are they the same years as our years? Or, you know, is it some other kind of year? What's really being involved here? Or is it the years, the distance between the person in the genealogy and some distant descendant? And it's not really the lifespan of the person. Some have argued that way. And I think that that is a possibility. We want to know, what do related biblical texts have to say about this passage? And the answer to that is, drumroll, nothing. There just is nothing said in the rest of the Bible about the extraordinary and unique old ages of these people. And then, too, there's this question of the relevance of science and history to make sense out of some of this stuff as well. And so, thinking about these things in terms of the long ages of these people from Adam to Noah, the reality is that looking at the rest of the Bible provides no real light into this issue. It is true that there's the range of possible meanings. Maybe, you know, maybe we're not really talking about a direct lifespan of someone lasting that long, but maybe it is a line of descent that is of some significance. Again, people have argued that. Yet at the same time, the language makes that difficult to accept. I wonder what science, things like that, have to say about this. It is interesting to note, when we think about aging, we are actually at a place today where we have not been at any point since this was written to actually understand the biology of aging. That indeed, on the chromosomes themselves are telomeres, which are the product of enzymes working on the molecular level inside the human gene. And these telomeres act as a protection on chromosomes from deterioration that happens every time a chromosome divides and new cells are created. The DNA strand itself is weakened, and it's telomeres that sort of protect it. We know that over the life of a cell, that these telomeres actually weaken, and every time that a cell is divided, it becomes less and less dynamic and less stable. And we can measure that against the presence of the telomeres in the cells. And so what does it mean? What it means is that, at least in theory, if telomeres were not being depleted from generation to generation in the life of a cell, it would be indeed possible for cells to go on for many hundreds of years. And there are indeed people spending a great deal of money today trying to understand the dynamics of how that works, because we want so desperately immortality in this life, don't we? And so there's a lot of research that has come out here. What am I saying? All I'm saying is this, that there is actually a biological basis for extreme longevity. And whether God, in his wisdom, decided that in the post-flood time to cause an advanced degradation of telomeres in the human genome and how it sequences out into cells, that may indeed be the case. That is a possibility. That could be an act of judgment on his part, perhaps, and also perhaps something more important still, which is to narrow the scope of human life so that human beings, people like you and me, don't live with the illusion of being eternal when we're not. The illusion of being immortal when we're not. That there will be an end to this life, and bigger questions face us than whether I'm going to live to be 100 years or 80 years or 200 years or whatever it is. So I just put that out to you, not because I have any particular skin in the game. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I do think that it's possible to explain longevity biologically, and that is the point here. Moving on. It says in chapter 6, then, we're going to talk about the flood. We go from these genealogies now to the terminus of the genealogy there, which is Noah. And it says in chapter 6, verse 1, that people began to multiply on the land, and daughters were born to them. And the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. That is an observation that has not gone away over the years. And they took for themselves wives, whomever they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. So a flood is going to come in 120 years. The Nephilim, it says, were on the earth in those days. And also the sons of God bore children with the daughters of men. And these were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thought of his heart was on evil continually. The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Wow, we're going to come back to that a little later. The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created, from man to animals, creeping things to birds, for I am sorry that I have made them. And then one of the really critical but clauses of the Bible. Everything's moving this way. It all looks bad. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And so now, again, another historical record, another Toledoth. These are the records of the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time, and Noah walked with God. Now let's think about this a little bit. Let's talk about the flood. Here we have an old cuneiform tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the about 175 flood myths that are just all over the world. It's hard to find a society, actually, except for in sub-Saharan Africa, oddly enough, in which flood stories are not virtually universal. Let's think about that just for a minute. Was there really a flood? I mean, really? How do we think about this? I'm aware of my own biases in thinking about this. I'm inclined to think, you know, I'm supposed to believe it, I know I am, but it just seems out there. Do you feel that way? Or am I just revealing my own cynicism? I think that in the back of our minds, we're like, I believe it, but yeah, maybe. Why? Because we live in a culture that just says things like that don't happen. We wonder, what are the range of possible meanings? And we need to examine that a little bit in terms of this text. Have we correctly understood what the flood narratives actually are teaching? And what are those biblical texts that shine some light on what's happening here? And is there something that we can glean from history and from science that would bring us into a clearer understanding of this text? And so I want to examine this question of the flood historically and to a certain extent theologically here tonight. Next week we're going to come back to it. We're really going to drill down in chapter 9 in terms of what God is doing and how God is at work in this flood story. Three things we want to discuss. The first of them is just this question, is this a myth? And again, the vast majority of people who look at this text, that's the conclusion they come to. They show parallels, however weak they might be, with the Gilgamesh story, which is Babylonian, which is a near neighbor of Israel, things like that. And the Epic of Gilgamesh has just sort of been put out there as this is the gold standard of comparison to the Old Testament. But there are some important differences. Again, the narrative style of Genesis cannot be ignored. That it is certainly not written in the poetic, epic genre of all of the other creation stories that surround Israel's neighbor. There's certainly something going on in the intention of the author to communicate something other than mythology. And second, of course, that the Bible itself, in a broader sense, affirms the historicity of this event. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 6, it says that the world was destroyed by water. That is in reference to Noah. And then more specifically in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 20, Peter says, God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water. Not a myth, not according to Peter, not according to the thought frame of the biblical writers. This is something that really did happen. But we need to think about this just a little bit. We may or may not be aware of the fact that there is actually substantial evidence in catastrophic floods from the end of the Ice Age, and which in significant ways are recorded all over the world, and which in significant ways correspond with that time that the Bible would place the flood of Noah. So I want you to not believe me, but think about this from the standpoint of a scientist who has spent considerable time and effort to investigate this very question, as is interviewed by ABC News. Check this out. You want to get us cooking there, Ryan?
Our journey to investigate the story of Noah and his ark led us to the banks of the Black Sea in Turkey, where we heard that tantalizing clues were being uncovered by Dr. Robert Ballard, one of the world's leading underwater archaeologists.
All right, let's get down on the deck. Get closer down.
We were astonished to learn that he believes the biblical flood could have actually happened, and he says he can find proof.
Something here. What's this?
If you were to discover definitively something that could pin science on the Noah story, how fantastic would that be?
Well, it would be pretty cool, and I'm confident we can. We just have to look.
And Ballard's track record for finding the impossible speaks for itself. In 1985, he and his crew tracked down the world's most famous shipwreck, the Titanic. and the blockbuster movie about the night she went down was based on Ballard's discoveries. Now, using advanced robotic technology, he's traveling even further back in time.
I'm putting a lot of money in the water, and obviously can't wait to see what it's going to see.
On a watery archaeological dig that might even support the Noah story.
So you're saying, as a scientist, that it is not a crazy thing to think that this happened and you can find evidence for it.
It's not a crazy thing to think that the flood stories of the various cultures, including ours, are based upon true cataclysmic events.
Ballard believes about 12,000 years ago, much of the Earth was covered in ice that began to melt. The oceans began to swell, causing a series of devastating floods all over the world.
We talk about the floods of our living history. Boy, they don't compare at all to the floods of ancient time. The question is, was there a mother of all floods?
Ballard thinks there was, and he's testing a controversial theory that the biblical flood happened here.
Why the Black Sea? Well, because the Black Sea appears to have had a giant flood. Not just a slow-moving, advancing rise of sea level, but a really big flood, and people were living there.
The theory goes this was once an isolated freshwater lake, but then when the Mediterranean swelled,
at some magic moment, it broke through and flooded this place violently.
What did Noah or the people who lived there during what you believe to be this huge flood, what did they see?
It probably was a bad day, and a lot of real estate, 150,000 square kilometers of land, went under.
And 400 feet below the surface, Ballard believes he's found proof of that catastrophic event.
I love it. I love it, I love it, I love it, I love it.
They unearthed an ancient shoreline.
Well, we actually dated it, about 5,000 BC.
And that is about the time that the Bible says
exactly.
Noah and the Great Flood happened. I mean, wow.
Wow. So it nailed it.
Ballard and others who agree with the so-called Black Sea theory believe the survivors of this traumatic event passed the story down from generation to generation and eventually inspired the biblical account.
Well, there you go. Is Ballard right?
I don't know.
It's hard to say. That's not really the point, though. The point is what is being described here plausible? Yes, increasingly it's been the case that as geologists and others have studied the effects of the post-ice age flooding around the world, they're finding exactly the kinds of things that Ballard is describing. And at about the time that the Bible would place the Noah event. And so this raises then a second question for us, and one hinted at in the piece, and that is the question of whether or not the flood described in Genesis 6 through 8 was local or universal. And I think most of us have just grown up with the thought that it's the flood that encompassed the entire globe and every mountain covered. But that is not the way that this thing has always been understood. And by an increasing number, actually, of biblical scholars who hold to the authority and the historical reliability of the Old Testament, many are putting forth, like Derek Kidner and other people like that, the idea that actually what's being described here, much like this video showed, was more of a local flood than a universal flood. Let me walk you through that. It seems a little bit hard to believe that we're talking about something that's local when language like all flesh that moved on the earth, every swarming thing, all mankind, all that was on dry land, all whose nostrils had the breath of life died. That sounds pretty global, doesn't it? But a couple things. One is, how global was humankind at this stage of the game? That's an interesting question and a difficult one to answer. But more importantly, how do we think of this language, all flesh, all mankind, and earth? And it is important to note that the word earth, eretz in the Hebrew, actually frequently relates not to the whole planet itself, but is really viewed from the perspective of the writer. And that earth really relates to the earth that they knew, the earth that they experienced. And so in the Joseph story at the end of the book of Genesis in chapter 41, verses 56 and 57, it says that when the famine was spread all over the face of the earth, then Joseph opened the storehouses. Well, certainly there was not famine all over the earth, but there was famine all over the life experience and the perspective of the writer of this story. Similarly, in verse 57, the people of all the earth came to Egypt. Really? From all over the earth? Again, that's not intended to be taken in that literal sense that we take it. And rather relates to the people that are in the Fertile Crescent, in Mesopotamia, and who are dealing with this significant drought. We know that the same history that we can measure, for instance, in China, doesn't have that same kind of destitution at that era of time. It's not the whole idea, the idea that the whole earth is experiencing famine or that the whole earth is moving to Egypt to find relief. So it just shows the flexibility with respect to the words. That's the important part here, and leaves open then the possibility that what's being referred to is something a little bit more local than universal. In the New Testament, the same language is used. Paul says in Colossians 1 that the gospel was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, was made a servant. Under all creation? In 30 years? That's not the case. The Bible, it took centuries for the gospel to spread out over the earth. In Acts chapter 2, verse 5, there were Jews living in Jerusalem, devout men from every nation under heaven. Again, that's just the perspective of the writer. And that's all it is intended to be understood as. And so we take this convention, hyperbole, maybe, exaggeration, or just simply the way that the word is meant to be understood. And we say that that's the same language that's being used to describe the flood story, and so there's nothing on the surface of it within the text, at least, that would indicate that we would have to view this as a global phenomenon. But probing a little bit further is the fact that if this were a global phenomenon, think about the fact that species from around the world have since that time migrated and evolved. But that would have to have occurred much longer, much further back in history, for these mutations and even the migration of which is spoken, for that to have actually taken place. We know the rate of the development of certain species, and it would be just really hard to imagine that the kinds that have been brought onto the ark would morph into broader species in that narrow period of time. And so I think that there's an issue with respect to how we understand this from the scientific perspective as well, if it is indeed a global flood. Ultimately, what we would have to say is that this is going to be a supernatural event either way. 120 years before it happens, God calls Noah because he knows he is omniscient. He sees the future, and he is going to act to preserve humanity through Noah and his family. Well, that's supernatural. And so what's to say is more supernatural, a universal event or a local one? You know, that's a fair point. It's a fair question. It plays to our question of bias. And then, too, we see the language about creation versus the language of flood in places like Psalm 104, verses 6 to 9, where the psalmist looks back to creation and he says, "You covered the earth with the deep, the waters were standing above the mountains." That sounds kind of like the flood. "At your rebuke, then they fled. The mountains rose, the valleys sank. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they will not return to cover the earth." And so this becomes sort of a difficult passage, in fact, for proponents of a universal flood to maintain, because here the psalmist is saying that from the moment of creation, God ordained nature such that the waters would fade away, that the continents would be formed, and that that is the way that God intended for it to stay. And of course, a global flood would violate that principle. A couple of just secular resources on this question. James Triffle in the Smithsonian Magazine a few years back has an article on this. The National Center for Science Education, which is a totally secular organization, it talks about this question, why was there a local large flood possible? In other words, seeking to harmonize for students the relationship between what they read in Genesis and the data of science. So it's not something that's fringe or weird science. The point is, everyone knows cataclysmic things happen that really look similar to the description given to the flood in Genesis chapter 6 to 8. The only lingering questions are, was it universal or local? Certainly it's not mythological. And moving on then is this most important question, which is what we want to kind of bring things home around here this evening and then pick up on again next week. Why the flood? Look what he says. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was on evil continually. That is a sorrowful description. The Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the flood is actually, needs to be understood in the biblical framework, is God's response to human corruption. That God will act in judgment. That yes, we are free to defy God. He has given us that capacity. But we are not free from the consequences of our rebellion. And we will experience within our own being the corruption that violating God's design and God's plan has for us. Well, many of us here tonight know just how deeply broken we are because of the concerted energy we have spent in our lives, living our life on our terms rather than God's terms. And so we are broken. We are a very broken human race. But not just broken in some psychological sense, but we're really bent in a moral sense. There's something wrong with us deep within the core of our being. And in that context, verse 6 is a very profound statement. The Lord was sorry that he had made man, that his heart was grieved. Now, was God surprised that man revolted? He was not surprised. He knew it was going to happen all along. He had something even better in store for a humanity that is in rebellion against him. And so he decided, yes, I will create this race of people, even though they defy me. And yet in that defiance, God himself is deeply wounded by this. God is not unmoved by the human situation. That's what we learn from the very early chapter of Genesis. God is not unmoved. God is not some philosophical abstraction that is so perfect as to never be impacted by the things going on in his creation. Not at all. The Bible describes God in deeply personal terms. And that human capacity to, on the one hand, feel a sense of rage for the terrible things that people do, and on the other hand, a deep sense of personal hurt at that a relationship has been broken, much to the profound detriment of the one who walked away from it. And God feels this. I love the words of the Jewish Old Testament scholar, Abraham Heschel, in his book, The Prophets. He says, the predicament of man is a predicament of God who has a stake in the human condition. Sin, guilt, suffering cannot be separated from the divine situation. Now, he's invested. He's all in. Man's alienation from God is not the ultimate fact by which to measure man's situation. The fact of God's participation in the predicament of man is the elemental fact. I love that. He's so right on. And it just fits right into this pattern that we've seen already so clearly in the book of Genesis, that though he is defied at every turn, and the problem with normal is that it always gets worse, and there is this downhill spiral to human society, nonetheless, God is moved to act, and he continues to pursue because he is deeply invested, deeply cares for the human predicament. Well, you know what that means, right? It means he cares for you and your predicament. And God has been pursuing you. That is the teaching of the scriptures in the Old Testament and in the New. God is not unmoved. God is aroused to move toward your pain and mine because that's who God is. Look what it says here in Exodus 34, 6 and 7. The Lord God. Moses says, show me your glory. Show me who you really are. I want to know you at the core of your being. And he says, okay. So here it is. Who is God? God is the transcendent, unmoving, unchanging, absolute power that knows everything. Yeah, but what's more important, the Lord God, the compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abundant in his hesed, his loving kindness. This is the most common term associated with God in the Bible. What is God's disposition toward us? Compassion. He looks at your situation and is like, oh my God, I feel your pain. That's what compassion literally means. He's gracious. In other words, that he it's not his desire to move toward moral failure with judgment, but rather to extend forgiveness. He's slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and truth. Those things are true about God. And because God is just, because he is the embodiment of moral perfection, because he is the governor of a moral universe, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. And so here we have this tension built right into the ancient pages of the Old Testament, don't we? God's impulse to be compassionate and gracious, to have that long fuse and to move towards us with loving kindness on the one hand, and the reality that he, as a just God, cannot leave the injustices that we do unaddressed and undealt with. And that tension is at the tension of the entire Bible's story. Until we come to that incredibly important place where the love of God and the justice of God converge on God himself in the person of Jesus Christ. Look what Peter says about this in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 18 through 20. He says that Christ died for our sins once for all, the just for the unjust. Okay, so there it is. Is God concerned about justice? Yes, he is. Will God act in justice toward moral failure? Yes, he will. But because he is compassionate, merciful, gracious, full of loving kindness, where will he express that need for judgment? Well, it says, Christ died for us. Why? The just for the unjust. He was innocent. We are guilty. So that he might bring us to God. Having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, he went and he made proclamation to the spirits now in prison who were once disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah. So we come back to that. See, the Bible presents us with a very unified picture of who God is and what God is about. And the story of the flood, the narrative of the flood, is just a very profound example of God revealing who he truly is. On the one hand, he is going to move in judgment toward the guilty. On the other hand, it is his deepest desire to exercise compassion. And so he keeps his stake in humanity alive through Noah and through Noah's family. That seed that began in Genesis 3, verse 15, is now moved through Noah. And in Noah, the preservation of the human race and the possibility of redemption. And that's going to be then the foundation and the backdrop for the rest of what unfolds in the book of Genesis. How does this plan take shape? How does he bring together his justice and his love in this promise that he's going to bless the entire world that is now under his judgment? So, the flood story is a super important one, and it's a profound one. And it really, again, illustrates this is what is at stake with us here tonight. For 120 years, Moses spoke to the people around him. He's building this ark. What were they thinking? Dude, what are you doing building this thing? What's going to rain? Really? What's rain? It said that it had not rained before at this point, in this place. And he's got 120 years to say, look at your life. You're created in the image of God, but look what you're doing with yourself. Look at the violence that you're bringing into your relationships. Look at the corruption of your own soul. You have time to turn to God and to seek his forgiveness, to seek his mercy. Do that. Walk with God. And this is the same thing that's really being put out here to you here tonight. We have a moment in time. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27 says that it is appointed man to live once, and after this comes their judgment. We will all stand before God. And that's just the sober reality that we see illustrated in the flood story. It's the declaration of Jesus Christ himself. And so I declare it to you. We're not okay with God apart from responding to, in a personal way, the offer to be reconciled to God through receiving forgiveness that comes to us through Jesus Christ. God gave us the free will that we have that has brought our life to the place that it has. And he's calling on you to use that same free will to make a decision to trust him for what you cannot do for yourself. You cannot make yourself right with God. You cannot make yourself who is guilty to be innocent. And yet yet God is coming before you here, and he's saying, I've got a way. I've dealt with this problem. And I'm calling on you to humble yourself, to take aside that pridefulness and that arrogance that says, I'm going to do it my way and on my terms, and I will yield to none, even if that one is God. And he's saying, that's the problem. That's the problem. Your problems are not intellectual problems. Is there a God or is this true? You know these things are true. Your problem is a problem with your pride. Now is the time to yield, to receive the forgiveness that you know you need. And that is undoubtedly the message from Noah all the way into the New Testament and down to this present time. There is a limited amount of time that God has appointed for you to make a decision that is going to affect where you are forever. Okay, so that's the flood.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.